You're listening to Midori House, first brocast on the 17th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Georgina Godwin. On today's show, fear is spreading across South Africa today as violent attacks on foreigners erupt into mass riots.
The government are doing their bit, actually, but they should do more. They should do more by, allaying the fears and letting the people go back to their homes.
What's caused this ignition of xenophobia? I'll discuss that with my guests today, Ivor Geber and Jeffrey Kaufman. Also ahead, the extravagance of his palace has proven rather controversial. But anyone thinking of poking a bit of fun at the Turkish president might be in for some legal strife. We'll also look at WikiLeaks' latest foray into a realm perhaps better suited to tabloid magazines. And the UK election battle is heating up. But is anyone paying attention?
I want to get rid of the Tories on May the 7th, and I think it's a disgrace that David Cameron's not here tonight to defend his record. But I want to see...
All that, plus a look ahead to our Quality of Life conference in Lisbon tomorrow. That's all to come on Midori House, with me, Georgina Godwin. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, Ivor Geber, and London-based correspondent for America's ABC News, Jeffrey Kaufman. Welcome both to the programme. Thank you for coming in on this beautiful evening. Now, we're going to start off looking at violence against foreigners in South Africa. Despite mass rallies calling for an end to increasing violence against foreigners in the country, tensions are continuing to rise this evening after police intervened by firing rubber bullets at an angry crowd. Foreign-owned shops across the nation have been looted while about 200 people sought refuge at a police station last night. The South African president, Jacob Zuma, has repeatedly called for calm, but so far the violence has only escalated as angry rioters accuse foreigners of stealing their jobs. Well, the unemployment rate in South Africa sits at around 24%, but there's actually no evidence to suggest that an abundance of foreign workers is in any way to blame for this. Is it, do you think, Jeffrey, merely a case of needing someone to blame?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a society that's very frustrated. South Africa is the strongest economy, the most developed economy in Africa. It's not surprising that people across its porous borders, looking from Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and other countries in southern Africa, looking for a better life. It's one of the things that struck me. I spent a lot of time in South Africa during Mandela's final years, and one of the things that really struck me was the number of people, particularly from Zaire, Zimbabwe, who had made their way to Johannesburg. And you do see them. It's a real presence. And there is this kind of latent racism. And it's this sense of disenfranchisement from poor blacks who obviously have had a really horrible journey through history in the last century in South Africa. And they're kind of venting, but you know the Zulu king is really not helping with this when he says that immigrants are to blame for all that ails South Africa.
Absolutely, Jeffrey there was talking about history and the fact that it's not a new thing. There've been frequent explosions of xenophobic violence over the past decade. Notably, I think in 2008. I mean, at one point there were around 3,000 people sheltering in a church in Johannesburg, and I'm wondering again, Jeffrey. Mentioned the past, if one can ever really get away from the fact that the whole society was completely indoctrinated by apartheid, even if you were a victim of that, can you walk away completely?
Well, clearly, as a result of history, South Africa is a country where ethnic identity, tribal identity is very strong. But it's also, as Jeffrey mentioned, the dominant economic power in that region. I spent a lot of last year in Malawi, and I was struck by the ambivalent relationship with South Africa, a bit like Europe and America, if you like, that they saw South Africa as the model, the place where their aspirations were, but they also resented South African power, and particularly these stories about violence against Malawians in that case were ongoing even then, nothing like this scale of this, but this has been a rumbling sore. Can a sore rumble? Anyway, a weeping sore in South Africa for many years. And certainly in Southern Africa, one was very much aware that this was an issue. However, the scale of the economic deprivation in a country like Malawi was such that people, just as they risk coming across the Mediterranean from North Africa to get to Europe, people will continue to run it because the alternatives are far worse. So this won't stop black, brown or whatever immigrants trying to get into South Africa because, relatively speaking, it's affluent.
Mm. Jacob Zuma, though, has not done a lot to quell the violence. I mean, he was quite slow coming forward, even condemning it, wasn't he, Jeffrey?
Well, and you know, Zuma is a problematic guy as a leader because he doesn't, you know, he does seem to stoke the fires of this kind of thing by, as you say, being slow and saying he's slow to respond and saying he's sympathetic. And his son has said some outrageous things and basically stoking the flames, and you know, the father hasn't condemned him. You know, this is, you know, as Ivor says, this is just a different version of what we see with the U.S. reaction to Latinos crossing the porous border, to as Ivor said, North Africans coming in to Italy, and you know, and that incredible camp on the other side of the Eurotunnel of North Africans trying to sneak aboard the Eurostar and the freight trains as they come into the U.K. I mean, this is just the way, understandably, people desperate for a better life are trying to find one. But the problem is that, you know, it's one story with UKIP and with the anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S. By certain elements of the Republican Party. But when you have a country like South Africa, which is not fully developed, which has terrible poverty and unemployment, you know, people lash out, and it's not surprising. I was going to say understandable. I don't want to say that word, but it's not surprising that they lash out at what's in front of them. They see the Nigerians and others prospering in business, and they say, wait a minute, why is a Nigerian running a business when I don't have a job? And, and you know, that may not be a fair equation.
Because there's a pattern of it in Africa with Asian businesses being resented. Mm. We're going
look
back
at 40,
Uganda, 50
yeah.
years, exactly. It's unfortunately, it's just, I mean, I don't want to be simplistic, but I will be. It's all about poverty.
Mm. Are we using the wrong word, though? We're saying xenophobia. Is it perhaps Afrophobia? They're not chasing Australians down the streets or British people.
There's not too many. No, yeah. I think it's the fact is wherever you have deprivation and crime, the main victims of crime are poor people. They're more accessible, easier to find. Whites in South Africa, if you drive around Pretoria these days, it's all armed encampments almost.
Yeah.
These people are get-at-able, trying to attack whites. There was one white woman dragged from her car, or her car was stoned. But in general, it's the poor blacks who are more vulnerable, and they get it in the neck.
Mm. Let's move on to our next topic now. And this is the problem with insulting Turkey's president.
Careful.
Does the Turkish government have a sense of humour? So cartoonists and journalists are finding out the answer, which would seem no. To insult the Turkish president is to risk heavy fines or a lengthy prison sentence under the strict current laws. Recently, two journalists from Turkey's most famous cartoon magazine, Penguin, were sentenced to 14 months in prison after they joked about the leader's sexuality on a recent front cover. Now, Turkey has a history of taking a hard line on insulting the head of state, so consequently, many citizens are worried about freedom of speech in a country which lies 148th of 180 countries in Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index. I want to look specifically at this cartoon before we widen out the discussion. It shows the president in front of his new, controversially extravagant palace. He says, we could at least have sacrificed a journalist for the inauguration. obviously, connotations of an Islamic ritual and, of course, the way that they treat the press there. The man welcoming him is shown buttoning a suit jacket with a gesture that was deemed to suggest that the leader is homosexual. Now, that's odd, isn't it? Because there are a lot of things about him having lots of affairs. So should this be about his sexuality, or is it his infidelity?
Well, in a chauvinistic society, that to suggest somebody is gay is far is an insult. To suggest they have many lovers is a compliment. So I suspect that's the way it goes. Whether that is a homophobic or a homosexual gesture, I have to say, is beyond me. But clearly, there is a major problem, and it goes back a long time. Predates Ergun. Turkey, secular Turkey, did not have a distinguished record of press freedom. I remember going to Istanbul many years ago as on a Council of Europe delegation. And it wasn't just an issue of PKK journalists writing sympathetically about the Kurds. It was journalists seen to in any way demean Turkey. And we can talk about the Armenian massacres, or is it genocide? I won't go there, but that's very relevant now. Yeah. But there's a deep and unpleasant tradition in 20th and 21st century Turkey of repressing journalists. And it's shameful in a country which is seeking membership of the European Union.
Listen, this shows the gradations of democracy. You know, we tend to look at the map as dictatorships and democracies. And having covered Latin America for 10 years, it's something that you know, I saw up close. You know, you see many different shades of democracy. And the interesting thing is that Turkey is meant to be the shining light of democracy in the Muslim world. You know, I remember covering the Arab Spring and when Libya was liberated, which seems so long ago now, and I said, what kind of country do you want? We want a Muslim Islamic democracy. And I said, well, is there a model? Mm-hmm. And the best they could point to was Turkey. But of course, it's meant to be a secular democracy. And what we're seeing in Erdogan's 12 years as first prime minister and now president is this drift towards a religious-based democracy, but the word democracy is being debased and debased. And to be clear, there has been a law since 1926 against insulting the president, the head of state, but it was rarely used until Erdogan took office. It's true that persecution of journalists has a long history, but this particularly insidious law is getting a lot of traction. I mean, if you look at the numbers here, it is staggering how thin his skin is. The number of complaints that he's filed over 477 requests in 2014 alone to remove content from Twitter. 256 people investigated for insulting the head of state, 105 indicted. I mean, this is paranoia and vanity unleashed and really, really unrestrained. And it's scary. You know, Turkey is a really important geopolitical player, an important ally for the West, and a pivot. You know, it really is the crossroads of Asia and Europe.
Mm. Going back to that cartoon for a moment, or at least to humour, I'm interested in how satire is different in different countries. French satire, for instance, completely different from the gentle fun-poking of the British private eye.
Well, I'm not sure British politicians would agree with you that it was so gentle. I mean, they don't throw people in prison, but they do get very upset. But you're absolutely right. I mean, humour is very culturally determined. And what we find hilarious. You tell a joke to a journalist in another country and they look at you rather blankly waiting for the punchline and say, well, that was it. So I do think, but it is a very powerful weapon. I think that politicians can take opposition, humiliation. There's a story running around today about the former Spanish president of the IMF who's being investigated for corruption. And the big story in Spain is the fact that when he was being taken into questioning by the police, they, as they do when they're arresting common criminals, is they play, as he was getting in the car, they put their hand on his neck to push him into the car. And that was seen as the ultimate humiliation. He can manage being charged with corruption by millions of pesetas or euros or whatever it was, but to be treated like a common criminal. So I think humiliation, which is part of humour, is a very powerful weapon in terms of politicians' egos.
It's a particular issue, though, in the Islamic world, as we saw with those Danish cartoons, as we saw with Charlie Hebdo and the response, you know, the Islamic response to, you know, by some people, to be clear. I don't want to tar everyone, but mm-hmm. but it is a cultural issue in some extremes. And you know, this is a reference to that they're just, it's not funny. And when it's not funny, you know, I take action. Thankfully, at this point, Erdogan, you know, is not going to the extremes of violence. But this is really worrisome.
Yeah, but I mean, does it beg the question, what is satire? Is it the mere act of making fun, or should it provide a sort of catharsis or a zen acceptance of the world's absurdities?
Well, yes.
well said.
We're moving on.
What kind of social critique should it offer, though?
It offers, when it's effective, is it expresses in humour or cartoon Something that's in the air, something that people relate to. You can't suddenly invent a joke about a politician which it doesn't touch.
That is well said. I agree with you. I think that's exactly, the untouchable can be talked about.
Yeah. So if you suddenly started, for example, in the British context, having cartoons suggesting the leader of the Conservative Party is gay, it wouldn't have any resonance because it doesn't relate to anything that's in the public air. Mm. But if you start saying that, for example, he jokes about him being a rich boy, it resonates because he is, and that's one of the darts that the opposition party has been using. So the essence of satire and humour is it has to relate to the audience's perception.
Is it also about punching up rather than punching down? In terms of you know, going not going for the victim. So you're going for the big target. You're never.
I think satire. You know, I think political journalists should go for the big guys. I mean, they're the ones who need to be kept in perspective. I mean, you know, if Erdogan were truly a leader, he'd be able to laugh this off, and this stuff would go away. Because I think the fact that he's got such thin skin is encouraging people in a certain way to keep throwing these darts at him. And can you? Yes.
I was just going to say, I think when the American president appears before the US press at their annual dinner and takes the mickey out of himself, I think that's a brilliant demonstration of democracy. I mean, it might be crass. He might have 100 script writers writing the script. But the fact that he's prepared, and maybe she in the future, stand up in front of the American public and make himself look silly, I think is a great tribute to the democratic spirit.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, Ivor Gaber and Jeffrey Kaufman. When we return, we'll be looking at the latest release from WikiLeaks, and also, in the light of so many other important issues in the world, we'll examine if there's much international interest in the British elections.
On Saturday, the 18th of April, tune in to Monocle 24 to hear full live coverage of Monocle's inaugural Quality of Life Conference, which is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal.
With the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe.
Our special guests include legendary typographer Eric Speakerman, renowned London-based designer Ilse Crawford, and the V&A's director Martin Roth.
The day's sessions will explore how media brands make our cities.
You'll discover how to build the perfect house.
You'll hear how to reinvent the high street and explore the role of culture in our urban spaces.
All that plus music from Luisa Sobral too.
Yes, intenção que vim de autocarro até, quem sabe bem.
And you can hear it all right here on Monocle 24.
Tune in for full coverage of the first Monocle Quality of Life Conference, live from Lisbon on the 18th of April. Our special coverage begins at 9 a.m. London time.
Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
To me, quality of life is being able to live in a cosmopolitan city with access to fresh air, green grass and water. I like to be able to swim. I live in the old city of Istanbul, in Beyoğlu, and this city improves my quality of life because it's split by a glittering stretch of water, the Bosphorus. I can see the Bosphorus from my window. I can see the super tankers chugging by, and it's really glorious to just jump on a vapeur and get to a meeting in another continent, and it makes life pretty wonderful. You can nip to the Prince's Islands at the weekend and swim in the very blue water of the Sea of Marmara just in half an hour. So that really makes life rather nice. Istanbul can teach the world a lot about quality of life because everything here is geared around service. You'll be offered tea at the fishmongers or at the butchers. You can have everything for home delivered. There are little carts around the place selling beautiful simits that are totally fresh, fresh juice. You can have a pomegranate juiced and it costs virtually nothing. So there are lots of local amenities and little nimble solutions to urban life that I think really people could learn from. And even though it's a completely mad metropolis, in so many ways, if you find the right spot, your quality of life is very high. The underground funicular, the second oldest of its kind in the world, built in 1895. So it's a bit of transport history, but it connects my flat in Galata with the bureau. So my commute to work is about 5 minutes long. So I can be at home with my baby boy for lunch and then back. So it's really that little piece of transport really improves my quality of life and stops me from having to hike up the hill.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We heard Monocle's Sophie Grove there talking about what quality of life means to her. And of course, our Quality of Life conference is getting underway in Lisbon tomorrow. We're broadcasting live all day tomorrow from the conference right here on Monocle 24. More about that shortly. Still with me are Ivor Geber and Jeffrey Kaufman. And now we're looking at WikiLeaks, a new phrase that I was introduced to just today. I had never heard it before, but perhaps you're familiar with it. Possibly you are, Jeffrey, because of the nature of where you come from. Has WikiLeaks jumped the shark?
Oh, yeah. Do you know where that comes from? That's a very strange and obscure reference that's become part of the lexicon in America. Do you remember the American show Happy Days?
Absolutely. The
with
Fonz.
The Fonz, exactly. So
you look
that,
a little bit like the Fonz, actually.
Oh, well, thank
Jeffrey.
You. Thank you. I'll move closer to the microphone. It's such a funny origin. That was one, the most popular show. What was in the 70s, I guess, or, on American TV. And there was an episode where the Fonz physically jumps a shark. I don't remember seeing it, to be honest. But that was seen as the moment the show just went too far, and people just thought this is stupid. And it was at a point when the show started to fail and it died. And so jump the shark has essentially meant you've crossed the line. It's kind of a popular cultural reference to crossing the line. And to answer your question, absolutely. There is no journalistic, ethical, moral justification for publishing stolen documents from a company. I mean, there's this self-serving stuff about, oh, they're in bed with the government. I just, you know, I went to the website. You can search the entire Sony stolen archive on WikiLeaks. They've, you know, instead of just doing a document dump like in the past, they've indexed it. You can now put in any word. I mean, I'm looking, I put in the word film, and there are all these things about awards and you know, internal documents about totally innocuous stuff. There is absolutely nothing to justify this. Ivor, are you going to disagree with me?
1% of, I agree with 99% of what you say, but you said there is never a justification for...
Oh, did I say never? No, yeah. In this case, there's nothing.
In this case, yeah. But there are corporate malfeasance, and as an investigative journalist, I would think it was justified to expose corporate wrongdoing.
Absolutely. But I mean, shenanigans with the government, what a surprise. A big company is trying to curry favor with the government. But to my knowledge, nobody's reporting that there's evidence of criminal activity. The fact that they're lobbying government does not justify. And if that were the case, by the way, why didn't they just publish those particular documents?
So is this about Julian Assange running out of things to say and re-releasing old information just so he stays in the headlines?
That's a pretty good summary.
There's some interesting similarities between Julian Assange and Rupert Murdoch, in the sense that they're both media moguls of one sort or another, and circulation, sales, attention, call it what you will, has always been a driver. And although Jeff has made a very strong ethical case, if you're a tabloid journalist in Britain, and I'm proud to say we probably have some of the most rapacious tabloid journalists in the world, you would have published some of this stuff. You know, gossip about celebrities sells, or at least they think it does. And I think the time to go through the 250,000 emails or whatever it is, they will find bits of gossip that papers like The Sun or the Daily Mail, with its column of shame as it's known, Mail Online, will find salacious stuff. And salacity, I think I've just made that word up, salaciousness sells. So you're absolutely right ethically, but professionally, I think this will turn into something of a mini gold mine for tabloid journalists.
I don't know. I mean, I get the tabloid reference, but I have to say, I'm disgusted by this, but I don't mind saying that Julian Assange is disgusting to me. So, you know, I think that he's a self-serving, vain man who uses morality to you know, this is him, he wanted to run for parliament. I mean, he's also going insane. How long has he been locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy here in London?
Two years, or three now.
I met Julian Assange for the first time about 4 years ago during the WikiLeaks story, and it was at a news conference at the front Line Club here in London, the journalism club, and he was revealing some WikiLeaks stuff. And this is what happened was just astonishing. He stood up in front of a room packed with journalists, and he said, "I have evidence." And to be honest, I have to look back in my files. I don't remember what the evidence was, but it was pretty damning, whatever it was he was saying. And he held up a CD-ROM, a disc, a data disc, and he said, "On this disc is proof that." And he went on and on, and then he said, "I'll take questions." And I put up my hand and said, "Can we see the disc and what's on it?" And he said, "No." I was flabbergasted. I said, "Well, how am I possibly going to report something based on the hearsay of what may be a blank disc?" And he said, "You know, I would never tell you something that can't be trusted." And we didn't do the story. I mean, what are you going to do? No, I mean, this is a man who is so caught up in his importance.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, we don't have a lot of time. I'd like to briefly look at the big story that's happening here in Britain, because it seems like the rest of the world's not particularly interested that in about 3 weeks' time, there's a major general election here, beyond the sort of echo chamber of Westminster, that not a lot of attention being paid. So the Guardian's latest average of polls has David Cameron's party 33.7%, Labour on 33.6%. No single party commanding a majority, which is interesting. But we were talking about satire earlier, and that's what I want to know about, is that can the women win it for Miliband? Because what's been happening is that certainly on Twitter, there was a huge push saying how hot he is. I'm using inverted commas there.
Really?
And then a lot of women columnists took this up, and they were all saying that Ed Miliband's really a very sexy man, and that actually that perhaps his hotness could be translated into leadership quality.
I'm not sure Geoffrey and I are very well qualified to comment on Ed Miliband's hotness.
Well, actually,
hotness.
I'm not asking you whether you fancy him or not. Sorry, but as a gay man,
I'm quite qualified to talk about it. I don't know what they're talking about. So well, to be perfectly honest, I think that's just something that the Labour strategist must have dreamed
up.
You know, yeah.
There is a serious point here that there is an increasing, and I'm now going to be boring professor of political journalism, there's been an increasing gender divide in voting behaviour in this country. And for a long time, more women voted Labour than men, because Labour was seen good on social issues, education, so forth. And then it switched, and more women were voting Conservative and put the Conservatives into power in 2010. And if Ed's alleged hotness leads more women to shift to Labour, that is politically significant. Mm-hmm. I don't yet see too many signs of it, but then I'm not seeing the private polling that the parties are seeing. But certainly, just to make a serious point, Ed Miliband's great advantage at the start of this election campaign was he was seen as a no-hoper. Mm-hmm. He only had one way, and he's gone it. He's gone up because people don't see him as a no-hoper. Cameron's still ahead in the personal ratings, but Miliband's had a good campaign because he hasn't flopped.
Well, this is something we'll be revisiting, I'm sure, a lot in the days and indeed in the 3 weeks to come. We'll have to leave it there. Before we do, we've been discussing the quality of life. That's our conference that starts tomorrow in Lisbon. Many people tell us that for them, quality of life is all about having more time. Now, if I had more time, I think I'd probably just try and work more. But I think one's supposed to smell the flowers and spend time with one's loved ones. So both of you, if you had more time to improve the quality of your life, what would you use that time for, Ivor?
What a rotten question. If you ask my partner, she'd say, oh, he'd just use it like to work. You know, there's just no point in giving him time off. It doesn't exist for him. I suppose I enjoy my work. But seriously, what I would do, I'd like to play more tennis, and I'd like to watch my team in the Premiership, which they're not going to be next season, but that's a private grief. Queen's Park Rangers I'm talking about.
Geoffrey.
Oh, I would spend it reading Monocle. I just never get through the magazine.
Oh, well, there's one guest who's definitely coming back. That was Geoffrey Kaufman and also Ivor Gaber. Thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all we've got time for today. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Henry Rees-Sheridan and Caroline Hammergren. Studio manager was Toby Hammond. Danny Giacopelli will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist next. And I'm Georgina Godwin for this edition of Midori House. It's goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.